Get 50% off the Safe Empowerment System for Anxiety, the audio you play when anxiety starts, to help you get through it and out of it. Head over to quietbegins.com.
Life presents the toughest challenges. Every day you are faced with decisions that test your ability to express who you really want to be in this world. We're told to keep saying affirmations and keep thinking positively, but what do you do when that stuff doesn't work? Welcome to the Overwhelmed Brain, where you'll learn to make decisions that are right for you so that you can create the life you want now.
Hello, this is Welcome to the Show. Oh. This is Paul Coliani, and I'm here to help you increase your emotional intelligence so that you can avoid dysfunction, handle toxic situations with grace and ease, and show up as your authentic self. Everything I talk about on this show is my personal opinion, and it's meant for informational and educational purposes only. Always consult a medical or psychological professional before making any changes that could affect your physical or mental health. You should hear some of the things that I delete from this show. I thought, okay, I'm just going to restart, but I just decided to leave it in. Welcome to the show. I am glad that you are here. There's something I want to talk about today that has to do with how to respond to snarky people, especially ones that seem to pick on you. So I'm not sure if this whole episode is dedicated to that or not, but I just read an email that I'm going to read you parts of that reminded me of the toolbox that I have that not a lot of people carry around with them. The toolbox that I have has to do with how to communicate with a lot of people in a lot of different circumstances. And when they are negative, communicating with them as well in a way that is empowering to me and not so much confrontational to them. In fact, it takes their power away. So I don't want to say it's disempowering to them, but if they have power over you so that they can control you or make you feel bad, then we don't want that. You don't want that in your life. You want someone that you can talk to on an equal level, where you can talk about anything and not have it be about making you feel bad. And I think that's a fair thing to ask. I think you should be able to expect someone to treat you with kindness and respect. I say that on my other show, Love and Abuse. You should be treated with kindness and respect, especially if you are treating others like that. And when you aren't treated with kindness and respect, and you are mistreated, disrespected, and feel like someone is taking away your power, then you need to come up with a good game plan so that your power doesn't disappear. Some people have the ability to take it away. And if you don't believe that, just hang around a diagnosable narcissist for a while and you will start to feel this. Unless you have these tools that I'm talking about. And even these tools aren't 100% effective because you can be duped. You can be conned into believing someone is kind and caring and empathetic when they're really not. I thought about doing this episode for my other podcast, Love and Abuse, but decided this is probably appropriate for any situation that we're in. It's not just abusive relationships. It's not just abusive people, because people can tend to be snarky. People can tend to be offensive with their words with the intent of wanting to dig at you and poke at you and make you feel bad. It applies in emotionally abusive relationships, of course, and it also applies to everyday people. You might have somebody mutter under their breath behind you in line, and you know they're talking about you. Oh, I was here first. You might hear that. And what do you do when that happens? I'm not saying I'm going to give you all the answers today to every challenge that comes your way, but I'll give you some things that you can use so that when there's a challenging person in your life, that you have some sort of go-to thinking. In other words, when they say this, what is your go-to thinking? In my experience with clients and people who've written in and just working with a lot of people, I've noticed that most people's go-to is a defensive response, or a lash out response. It's not often a productive response. So you can be defensive. Like a defensive response might sound like, why would you say that? I'm doing the best I can. It took me 3 weeks to get here and I did all this stuff and now you're telling me this. You know, that's pretty defensive. You're explaining why they're wrong about you. And when you're in a defensive response with certain people, that's exactly where they want you to be. I do talk about this on my podcast, Love and Abuse, where the emotionally abusive person wants you to be in defense mode. These people want you to be defensive because if you're defensive, where's your focus? Your focus is on you. It's not them and their bad behavior. It's on you. So if your focus is on you and explaining yourself, that's exactly where they want you to be. It keeps them from having to explain themselves. So when you become defensive with certain people, remember certain people want you to be there. And if that's the case, you need to change your game. You need to change it up a little bit so that you don't act defensively. What? I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry. I thought you wanted it this way. I'll try harder. You know, that's a defensive response as well. Anything where you have to explain your behavior in a way to show them that you meant well can be seen as a defensive response. So you have that. Then you have the offensive response. How dare you blame me? You're the one that does all this stuff. You're the one that causes all these problems. You sit there and you blame me for this and you do all of that? That's the offensive response. You are attacking back. And the offensive response, again, some people want you to be there. Because now, even though you're focused on them, you're still taking time to explain to them what they're doing wrong. So this explaining process keeps the focus off of them, even though the focus is directly on them. But they don't have to talk because you're doing all the talking. So the offensive response puts you in the same spot as the defensive response, where you're taking up all the energy and the time to talk to them, explain to them, to make them see something differently. And when you're in that position, they don't have to do anything. They can be quiet. They can watch you lose it. They can watch your energy deplete. And while they're watching that, they feel like they're in control. Not with everyone. Some people don't like the offensive response. Some people would rather have you in the defensive response. It's a lot easier for them to go through life with others defending themselves instead of trying to come back offensively and put them down. Now, you also have a lashing out. There might be more than three, but I'm going to use these three. You have the defensive, the offensive, and then lashing out, which can be a mixture of both. Lashing out is just screaming or hitting back or pushing back or how dare you? It sounds the same as offensive, but lashing out is more of a immediate fight or flight triggered response. They're all pretty much fight or flight responses if we were to break them down, in my opinion. But the lashing out is the quick knee-jerk reaction, I don't have time to think, this is what's coming out of me response. That can actually be effective sometimes, but that is also very much you losing it in front of them, you taking up all your time and energy and expending that so that you become depleted. And again, they are in a position of power because you appear to be the irrational one, especially if this is done in front of others. So if you are doing this, offensive, defensive, or lashing out in front of them and in front of others, then they're going to look like the sane one and you're going to look like the insane one or the person who's just going crazy. And the person that's putting you in that space, they shine because they look rational. They're not spending any time or energy explaining anything. They just say a few words like, you're always late. They may say something so simple and seemingly benign as that, even though that could tick someone off, but that's the point. They know that a few simple, seemingly benign words will press your buttons. They know exactly what words to say, and they're going to say those words so that you will deplete your energy. What happens when you deplete your energy? It's hard to stay focused. It's hard to look sane. It's hard to stay rational. you become irrational, and it's a huge component of gaslighting. If somebody can keep you in an irrational space, then that is a part of crazy making or gaslighting, and it makes you not only look irrational to a lot of other people, but feel irrational in yourself. Because what happens is that when you settle down and that challenge is over, you think back to all the things you could have or should have said or did, and you think that maybe you didn't handle it well enough. I don't know about you, but every time I've lost it on someone, I think back and consider what I should have done differently. Oh, I should have said this. I should have been more calm. I should have shown them the evidence instead of just yelling at them. You know, I could have done a lot of things, but I didn't think about it in that time because I was reacting. I think it's important to be proactive when it comes to certain people. Proactive means carrying your toolbox with you. You may not have the tools. You may have a lot of the tools. But sometimes when this happens, you're reactive and all the tools that you've been carrying around, they fell out of the toolbox. You don't have them anymore because you become myopically focused on doing this next thing because you're reacting. Offensive, defensive, lashing out, whatever it is. And when you're in that state of mind, it's hard to access resources. So this is why you plan ahead. You be proactive. What is the plan? What should you plan ahead? You should probably have some responses. I mean, this comes from a private Facebook group I run where somebody said, you know, I'm writing down this list of responses. So when he says a certain thing, I'm going to respond with this. And I read through her list and I was like, this is brilliant. They're not emotionally charged. In fact, they don't even have emotions in the responses. That can be very powerful. That can be you being in control. If you can respond without an emotion attached, you know, think stoicism times 10. You can respond in a way that doesn't show someone your actual emotional state, meaning if you're angry and they can't tell that you're angry, and you convey a message to them that doesn't include the words of anger, they're going to be a little confused because they're not going to be able to read you well. Some people can read us without the words, for sure. But a lot of people that want you to feel bad, they listen for the words. They wait for those words. And they also look for your body language, too. They know that look. They know what it means when you nod your head or you roll your eyes. They know all this stuff. So you need to be hyper aware of your body language and the words you use. But focusing today pretty much on the words you use, because what will end up happening is that you will be in situations where somebody will say something to you and you will want to respond. And the body language won't mean as much because the words don't necessarily have to be congruent or in alignment with the body language. And what I mean by that is that sometimes you'll be very angry that somebody said something to you, and it'll show on your face and it'll show in your gestures. But when you speak and the anger isn't in your language, it might be confusing to them. It should be confusing to them because they're waiting for your typical response. What is your typical response? My typical response is to be angry and lash out. Well, if that's your typical response, you're going to get the response you expect from them. So this is where we have to be proactive in how we respond to people instead of react to people, so that when they do something to tick us off, make us upset, make us feel bad, that we don't automatically fall into that state of mind. Once you fall into that state of mind, you're in that old pattern. We don't want to be in that old pattern. You want to be in a new pattern that you create that allows you to control the conversation. And I tell you what, if people are used to making you feel bad and putting you down, controlling the conversation with people like that, it drives them crazy. You want to see the roles reverse? It's going to reverse. They may not act out as much, but they're not going to know what to do because their old patterns don't work anymore, their old behaviors. If they know your buttons and they press those buttons and you say something that has nothing to do with that button press, has nothing to do with your typical reaction, they're going to be confused. because people like that rely on you reacting. They rely on it. Think about the people in your life that say certain things just to make you upset. They know it makes you upset. That's why they do it. And if you know that's why they do it, why give them that pleasure? Why give them the honor of reacting as they expect you to react? If they're out to make you feel bad or upset you in some way, don't give them that pleasure. Because when you do, you end up falling into their game and they control the conversation. So this is all about taking your power back, taking the control back in interactions that typically end up with you being offended or upset or hurt in some way. This isn't about normal conversations where you're going to influence them and control them, and now you become the person that hurts their feelings. I don't really go in that direction. I just like to take the Tai Chi route. If you've ever done Tai Chi, this is the metaphor I use for conversations that don't go well. If somebody is expressing something to you that is designed to hurt you or make you feel bad, I could equate that to a verbal punch. Like they are punching you with their words. Not physically, that's a different scenario, but they punch you with their words. They say something that hurts or makes you feel bad. In Tai Chi, what you do when a punch comes at you is you move to the side and you allow it to pass. Not only that, and this isn't the totality of Tai Chi, I know, but when you move to the side, you help that verbal punch go past you. You actually pull it along right past you. So you step aside, you help that verbal punch go right by you. In real Tai Chi, you might even assist their arm going by you. And all of their energy has nowhere to land. And what that does to them is depletes their energy, not yours. You keep your energy because you give no resistance. Resistance is the key in most of this, what I'm going to talk about today. As soon as you give resistance, you expend energy. As soon as they throw this verbal punch at you, whatever words they use, and you step to the side and help it go right by you, they're depleting their energy. They're expending their energy. And now they're a little winded and have to reset. They have to go back to their position or face you again. And if you are able to sidestep every verbal punch that comes at you, they won't want to fight you anymore. They won't want to communicate with you in the same way anymore because all of their old behaviors don't work anymore. This is probably one of the most important things I learned in Tai Chi, and it has nothing to do with the physical movement, even though that's obviously helpful as well. But when it comes to language and communication, I've learned that resistance in communication depletes your energy, and allowing somebody else's energy to go right by you helps you keep your energy and helps deplete theirs. So it's important to understand that every time you offer resistance to someone, like, you can't do that to me, or I can't believe you said that, or you have to explain yourself, like, I didn't mean to do that, this is what I meant. Think of all the energy you're expending and think of all the resistance that you're giving them. Resistance is key. In fact, if you're going to take anything away from today's episode, think of how you resist anything. Think of how you resist anything and how much energy that uses and how you can feel tired after that, depending on what you're resisting. So when you think of having a conversation with someone that always turns into something hurtful or something that makes you upset, think of how you resist in those conversations and change it up. Change it up on them. And as soon as they realize that their verbal punches aren't landing, they're either going to change their approach, which you have to be aware of, or they're going to be confused. I love when they're confused. When they get confused, they get tired, they get disorganized, they don't have a plan anymore, they don't have a system anymore, and now they have to figure out how to talk to you. You're going to make it difficult for them, but they are the ones actually making it difficult for themselves because they are trying to make you go off balance by doing what they're doing. But if they treated you with kindness and respect, then they wouldn't be off balance, because there would be no reason for you to sidestep their verbal punches, because there wouldn't be any. And if they aren't throwing those verbal punches and they aren't sending you negative energy in any way through their language or even physically, if they stop doing that, then they stop their own self-sabotage, because that's what happens. Emotionally abusive, hurtful people will sabotage themselves and their own relationships by doing behavior that comes back at them and takes away the very things they want. Hurtful people lose what they want because they try to control the things and people they want. So it's typically with people. They will always end up losing the people they want because they want to control those people. And they control those people by keeping them in that offensive, defensive, or triggered, lashing out state. And you don't want to be there. You don't want to be in the state that they want to put you in. And once you're out of that state, it gives them another choice. Wow, my old pattern doesn't work. You don't offer resistance. What do I do now? I guess I could choose to act kinder. I guess I could choose that. You actually open the door for them to have that choice. Not that it's your responsibility, but this is what can happen. When we come back, I'm going to read you parts of that email, and I'm going to give you some tools that you can use during this verbal Tai Chi that will help you get through moments so that you don't have to offer so much resistance. And in fact, you can offer no resistance and change the entire outcome of the communication. Hopefully, that's the goal. We want to change the typical outcome into something new, something manageable, and something that isn't so tiring and even productive. That would be nice. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Like I said, I'm going to give you those resources, the tools that I carry around with me. So when somebody comes along that's snarky or hurtful or emotionally abusive, you have a way to respond that isn't about resisting them and more about allowing their energy just to pass right by you, allowing that verbal punch to go right by you so that you don't feel it at all and they expend energy throwing it at you. What can you do? Let me read some of this email and we'll go in that direction. This person says, I will tell you in all honesty, your podcasts have been a major contributor to my healing process. I'd say I'd listened to 98% of your episodes with both The Overwhelmed Brain and Love and Abuse. I've come a long way in terms of the relationship breakdown. I will own my part in the breakdown and I have very minimal contact with my ex. We do have to attend events with our children, but he still has a snide remark, usually on my appearance. But I get where that comes from now, and I don't react. All right, so there's more to this email, but I'm going to stop right here and give you one of the resources that I use. Because as soon as I read that he still has a snide remark on my appearance, the first place I went is something that they teach salespeople, which is handling the objection. And what that means is you handle the objection before the objection comes. So person's on the showroom floor, they're looking at the nice red expensive car, salesman comes along and they start talking and this person says, wow, I'd really wish I could afford that car. The salesman says, oh yeah, that's an expensive car. That first thing, you know, that's an expensive car. What is he doing? He's agreeing with the person saying that he can't afford it. So he's allowing that consumer's energy to go right by. Like the consumer said, I wish I could afford it or I can't afford it. And I'm going to assume he expected the salesman to say, well, you know, can you afford, you know, $500 a month? We can work something out. We can talk about a loan. We can, you know, do all this other stuff. So already the consumer might have his guard up like, oh yeah, he's going to talk me into it if I say anything. But what the salesman did was something smart. He decided to agree that the car was expensive. And the first tool that I'm giving you today for your tool belt is to step into their perception, to step into the other person's reality. The other person's reality is that car is too expensive. The salesman says, oh yeah, yeah it is. There's no resistance. Remember that keyword, resistance. There's no resistance. So the consumer who expected to be sold to is now hearing the same thing that he just conveyed. What does that do? That builds trust. I'm not saying this works with hurtful people, building trust and all that, because you might have a history. But these people don't have a history. So the salesman says, oh, yeah, that is an expensive car. I totally agree. Whoa, where did that come from? That builds trust. That shows that the salesman's probably honest, like not trying to bamboozle the guy. That's good. So now the consumer feels a little bit more comfortable talking to the salesperson. Hey, you didn't try to tell me that it wasn't expensive. You didn't try to say that we could do a monthly payment thing. You didn't do any of that. You just met me in my reality. You met me there. And that's where I wanted to be met. I wanted agreement there, even though I might not have thought that in the moment. I might not have thought, hey, I hope this guy agrees with me. But when the salesman did agree with him, suddenly he felt more comfortable. How do you do this with people that you've known for a long time? Like this person says, he still has a snide remark, usually on my appearance. So I want you to think about this. Let's just say that your ex, you have to see this person. And when you see this person, he or she comments on your appearance to try to make you feel bad. What would you say if you didn't want to offer resistance? Even using the example I just used, what would you say so that you didn't offer resistance to the person saying it? Pause if you need to. If you came up with something that didn't offer resistance, congratulations. Even if it, you know, wasn't that good, you don't know. You may not have these tools yet, or maybe you do. But the first place I go, if this happened to me, is I step into his world and agree with him. Oh, that's awful. Why would you do that? Why would you agree on your appearance? Because I don't want to give him the resistance that he expects. So in this person's case, she may not want to agree that her appearance is unappealing or unattractive. She may not want to, but that's not even the point. The point is catching him off guard, disarming his disempowerment weapon. That's what you're doing. We want to disarm the person who disempowers. We want to disarm them. So how do you do it? In this case, one way could be when he makes a snide remark on her appearance, like, oh, you're wearing that dress again. Didn't you wear that like last time we met too? Is to step into that reality. He saw me wear this dress before. So instead of resisting that, I'm going to say, oh yeah, I wear this all the time. What I did there was I didn't become offended. I didn't defend. I didn't lash out. I did something totally unexpected. Oh yeah, I wear this all the time. I love it. And the way I'm saying it, I'm owning it too. There's another tool. The first tool is being in agreement. Second tool is owning it. I know I'm going to lose count of these tools, so forgive me. But first tool is agreeing. Now, agreeing, people aren't going to like that. Some people are going to say, no way am I going to agree with some of the things that person says to me or about me. No way. I'm not going to do it. That's fine. It doesn't always have to be agreement. I just look for the easiest way to disarm the person who disempowers. How do I disarm that person? Because remember, it's not really about you. It's not about the words. It's not about truth or fiction. It's not if they're right or wrong. It's nothing about that. It's about disarming the person who disempowers. And when you do that, when you say something to them that throws them off, that is the first step to disarming them so that they don't take your power away. So she may not like, and I agree, she may not like that she gets these snide remarks from her ex, but when she's in this position, she could always say, oh yeah, that stain on that shirt, I've had this for a long time. Totally. It's funny to me. She could say that. Now, if he is the way I think he is, he's probably going to say, well, it looks ugly. It makes you look like a trash can. That might be a trigger for her. What do you do with that? Because now it's insulting. It makes me look like a trash can, huh? What do you say? So I think about, okay, I don't want to give him resistance because he exploits my resistance. He wants me to resist. He wants me to be offensive, defensive, or lash out. He wants to cause me to react. Now, she says I don't react, which is great. That's another tool. Another tool is gray rock technique. I talk about that in Love and Abuse. The gray rock technique with certain people is when you react like a dull, cold gray rock. You ever find a gray rock and see if it was happy or sad? Could you figure out if a gray rock had emotions? The point is you can't. You can't tell what a gray rock is growing through because they don't. They don't have emotions. I mean, some people may disagree, but for all intents and purposes, let's just assume that a dull gray rock isn't going to have a reaction or even much of a response. And if they do respond, it's just going to be okay or something like that. Or okay, if you say so. That could be a gray rock response. The gray rock response contains no emotions, no opinions, doesn't contain much of anything that they can exploit. So having a gray rock response to someone that is trying to trigger you can be very helpful. And that's going to drive them crazy because they want you to react. They want to get that reaction out of you. But when they can't, they're not going to know how to talk to you. So it's another little tool, using gray rock and just being non-responsive, no matter what they say or do. You look like a dirty trash can. That shirt is 20 years old. It has all these stains on it. If people only knew what was in your closet. Trying to insult you, trying to make you feel bad, trying to trigger you. The gray rock person's probably going to say, yeah, you're probably right. There's another tool. You're probably right. I've used this over and over again in my life. You're probably right. Where's the resistance there? There's no resistance. The you're probably right response is beautiful. You can use this a lot. Again, this isn't about you trying to defend yourself or explain anything or make sure that they understand that they're wrong or explain to them that you're a better person. It's not about that at all. Because as soon as you jump into that space, they're going to find a way to latch onto something that you said and bring it back to something hurtful. I'm not saying with everyone. I'm saying there are types of people that do this, and you know who they are in your life. So if you have somebody like this in your life, this is where these tools come in handy. So when they say something hurtful or offensive, and they want you to have an emotional response to it, instead of having an emotional response, you say, yeah, I've had this shirt for 20 years, lots of stains on it. Yeah, you're probably right. What are they going to say? They have no way to bully you anymore. They have no way to intimidate you. You've taken their power away. Their power used to be that when you reacted, that energized them. That gave them the ability to hurt you. And since I don't want them to hurt you and you don't want them to hurt you, you want to be able to say something that just takes away their ability to do that. There are several tools right there, and we haven't even finished this email, but we can use these tools. Just those four alone can be very helpful in everyday conversations with people that are difficult. So gray rock is a great one, and you're probably right. Something I use when necessary, and it's very helpful. And something else I started to talk about, but I didn't really expand upon, was handling the objection. This is, I guess, number five. Handling the objection is mentioning something before they mention it. This is a beautiful technique as far as I'm concerned. If you know that someone is going to mention something, like she says, about your appearance, then you figure out before you meet up with them what they're going to talk about. And if you can't figure it out, just make something up. Just make something up like, okay, there's a stain on your shirt and you believe that that person's going to say something about that stain. So bring it up. Hey, did you see this stain? Check it out. I figured you'd say something about it, so I'm just pointing it out to you to save us both some time. A little sarcasm in there, but it can be effective. Because now, how can they use what they were going to say against you if you've already said it? It disarms their ability to disempower you. It takes away their power. It takes away their control. It puts you in control. Hey, did you see my hair? Look at this. It's uneven over here. It looks ridiculous. They may say, yeah, it does. You look stupid. They could totally ride that wave that you put out there. But what do you do then? Do you start to give resistance then because your technique didn't work? No. You say, oh, yeah, I'm with you. Totally stupid. I can't wait to change it. Again, it's not about your hair. It's not about if it's true or not. It's not about if it's hurtful or not. It's about disarming them. It's disarming to them when you agree with them. It's disarming to them when you point out things that they want to point out so they feel like they have control over you. We don't want to give them control. We want to show them that we're in control and that anything that they say doesn't really hurt you anymore. They're trying to hurt you. They're trying to make you feel bad. They're trying to put you in that disempowered state. But you suddenly have these tools and now you're empowered. Now you're in control. And that's a much better space to be in. Let me continue with this email. I continue to have nights where I dream of him telling me what a poor type of person I am and look what I have done to him and his children. Oh, there's a good one. So now he's trying to make this person feel guilty. How do you do that? Should you agree with this person then? Should you say you're probably right? No, that doesn't work with every scenario. This is hitting on something maybe deeper that you don't necessarily want to agree with, but I would tend to go more gray rock with something like that because it's still looking for resistance and a reaction. In this case, he's still looking for that because why would he say that stuff? He wants her to feel bad. Look what you've done. You're such a poor type of person or whatever he says. And look what you've done to me and my children. I mean, you want to say, hey, look, you did it to yourself, pal. What is that? That is the offensive response. You're on the offense. You're saying, you did this. It's your fault. You caused all these problems. But if we do that, what does that do? It opens the door for more arguing. It opens the door to old triggers that come up again. And now we have to deal with that. So what's a good response here? My first thought is to go, that's it. Kind of like a sigh. Maybe this is number six. I don't know. I'm even shrugging my shoulders. You can't see. It's almost like you're saying, oh, well. Or maybe you're saying, oh, life's tough. But I'm just saying, that might tick them off. That might make them say more like, oh, you don't have a defense for that. So I'm right about all this. And you can, again, respond, just say something like that. And I know this is a very sensitive thing. Some people are very affected by this because most kind people that are mistreated will often take the blame, will often think they are at fault. Typically, the kind, generous, caring person is not the one at fault. It's usually the one that's trying to hurt them. It's usually the one that's emotionally abusive, difficult, does bad behavior, always trying to make them feel bad, where the kind, caring, generous person never puts the other person down. It's usually how it goes. Sometimes they do, but it's usually in that offensive way because they were hurt by that person in that moment. So they become offensive saying, well, you're the one who caused all this. And that's when it can look irrational to do that, which is why I'm giving you these tools. So as you go forward and you have these types of conversations, you might come up against someone that says something that hits your heart so hard and so deep that how do you defend yourself there? How do you explain that it was their fault? What do you do? I want to eliminate the resistance because any resistance I give, it's going to create an argument and I don't want that. So I might just do one of the other things, 1 through 5 or number 6, sigh. I don't even know if sigh is the right word. It's just whatever, kind of, if you say so, I don't care. If you think that, that's your thing. But I'm not saying any of that stuff. I'm just saying that monosyllable sound. The inflection can convey a lot without saying much at all. And that's another thing. You have to remember that the more you explain or the more you talk, the more that can be used against you. So remember this, it's like getting arrested. Anything that you say can and will be used against you. You have to be careful how much you talk with people that want to make you feel bad or hurt you. So if you decide to explain something, if you decide to get into a long-winded explanation of something that you're doing that they commented about, they're going to find something to latch onto and bring it right back on you. Especially if there's any type of emotional charge in what you're saying. If there's an emotional charge in what you're saying, then they know they've already pushed a button and they're going to push it even harder. Or they're going to find related buttons and push those buttons. So we have to be careful with that as well. Now, I will say this. She did say that him saying that she was a poor person and look what she did to him and his children were dreams. She says, I have nights where I dream this. So I treated it as if it were a real thing, just in case it really happened. She said, these dreams can be very traumatic. They usually make me feel like I have a dark cloud following me for the next day. Just the mention of his name makes me very nauseous, and sometimes when my children speak about him, I struggle. But I want them to be, quote, normal, so that they never see me react. Sometimes I feel like I have PTSD. I wonder if I do. I'm going to say, yeah, you probably do, because anytime you have an emotional response, a triggered response from your children mentioning his name or you thinking about him, it's PTSD. It's something unresolved in you. It's something unhealed. So I'm just going to kind of go off on a little tangent here with these tools and tell you what maybe you could try here, which is the visualization I talk about in other episodes. Let's picture him purposefully in front of you and allow all these emotions to come up. You know, if you get angry, that's what needs to come up. Just have this visualization in your mind. There he is in front of you. If anger comes up, great. If sadness comes up, great. If you want to explode, great. This is self-validation. You deserve to feel what you feel. And as you're visualizing him in front of you, do whatever you want to him. Say or yell or scream anything you want to him. Punch him, kill him, do anything you want to him in your mind, in your visualization, because it's your mind and you can do anything you want and no one's there to judge you. No one's there to tell you it's wrong. Not that you'd really do this in real life, but because you need closure. You need to start healing from this. And sometimes the emotions that we carry around and the triggers that we carry around need closure. They need a resolution. And they also need a voice. They need expression. You might have a lot of anger inside of you, and picturing him in front of you and allowing yourself to express that anger and any words or screaming that you feel are in there will help you start to release the pressure that has built up for so long. You need to release this pressure. PTSD is a lot of pressure. You're carrying it around. So picture this person in front of you, and if you get everything out and there's still more in there, do it again. Take a break. Do it tomorrow. Do it the next week. Do it again. You need to get this stuff out of your system. You can't hang on to it. You need some sort of relief or release. And that is one way to do it. Of course, talk to a therapist or a counselor, you know, talk about this stuff. It's always helpful to talk about this stuff with someone. But what I appreciate about this visualization process is that you will have these emotions built up in you. And the safest place to express these emotions is inside you and through your own thought processes, and even verbally outside of you. When you scream it, when you say it, when you punch a pillow, whatever it is, and doing it either around safe people or no one at all, and just imagining that he is there and you say the things that you've wanted to say. And when you do, you're giving your emotions a voice. You're giving them expression. You're allowing the pressure to release and relieve yourself of continuing to hold on to these old emotional triggers. So I want you to remember that. I want you to do it. I want you to experience what it's like so that you can reach some sort of closure. I'm not saying it's going to close everything right away, but I will say that doing this helps you relieve some of the pressure so that when you see him again, that same pressure isn't there. Or when your kids mention his name, you might actually have a little bit of a chuckle because of what you just did to him a few hours before. I know it sounds a little bit irresponsible for me to say this. If you have that much PTSD, you definitely need to speak to a professional. But at the same time, if you're already doing that, which I think you say in your letter you do, I'm going to read it in a moment, then this is an extra tool that you can use to help you through it. So let me continue and start to finish up this letter. But I hope you're able to use that process, use that method to help you start to relieve this pressure inside of you. And as you relieve the pressure, the PTSD hopefully will wane, it will lessen, and maybe even go away completely. I remember doing this with my stepfather. I would just, I had punched him, I killed him, I did everything I could inside my mind until he no longer bothered me. And it doesn't mean he's dead in your mind. It means that you just got it out of your system. And then next time I saw him in my mind, he didn't have that same effect. I mean, I had already killed him, I'd already hurt him, I'd already yelled at him, I've done everything. Then I realized, well, I guess I didn't need to kill him, but I'm glad I did because I took that pressure out and I don't really want him dead. I mean, of course not. I don't really want the stuff that I did to him to be true. I just needed to give my emotions a voice. I just had to allow them to be expressed. so that they wouldn't continue building pressure inside of me. And that really, really helped. That was a good healing process for me. And maybe it'll be for you too. Let me continue and finish up with your letter. You say, I have wonderful children, all very successful in their own lives, and I have a wonderful relationship with them. I try not to think too far beyond that. I'm a fiercely independent woman and struggle with dropping my guard to just anyone. I have a very dear friend that has waited and waited for me to be ready for a relationship, and I'm getting there, and he is a very patient man. Okay, so I'm reading that you have a possible relationship in the works, and you are working on yourself so that you will be ready to be in a relationship. I think this is so good. This is so healthy. It is such a good decision for you. I believe that we need to work on ourselves and bring the best version of ourselves into our relationship and not a highly dysfunctional version of ourselves into the relationship, only because we end up, you know, talk about depleting the energy of the other person. If you bring a lot of dysfunction with you into a relationship, what ends up happening typically is that we pull the healthy stuff out of them and try to give it to ourselves. If that's a little confusing, I apologize, but let's just say that I got into a relationship and I was awfully clingy and needy, which I've definitely done in the past. And I relied on them to always be there. And I always wanted to be with the person. And I always wanted to be near her and be close to her. And wherever she went, I wanted to be. It all sounds like, hey, that would be a great relationship. But at the same time, I came from this really desperate, needy, clingy space that it started drawing it from her. So her lovingness was being drawn and draining her. Her kindness was being drawn out of her from me. I was pulling it out of her and draining her. I was just taking more than she had. This is what happens when you bring your dysfunctions into a relationship. You withdraw what you don't have from the other person, and it starts to drain them, and it starts to make them feel less loving toward you, and they want to distance themselves from you. And sometimes they don't even know why, because you have the same personality that you walked into the relationship with, but suddenly they're starting to fall out of love with you and you can't figure it out, or they're distancing themselves and you just don't know why. You got to look at your own dysfunctions. You got to look at what needs healing inside of you and ask yourself, am I drawing it from them? Because if I am, then they're not going to be able to sustain that. And as long as you continue to draw from them, they will eventually feel so drained that they won't want anything to do with you anymore. They'll want to get away from you. This is what happens, unfortunately. We bring our own dysfunctions into the relationship, and then we expect, maybe that's not the right word, but we draw the healthy, good stuff from them so that they don't feel so healthy and good anymore. When I was married, my wife was getting depressed, and I really thought it was all about her. But it was all about me. I was drawing it out of her. All of my dysfunctions, I was trying to make up for by taking them away from her. And that's a process. It's just how we behave toward each other. And she felt that draw and she couldn't explain it. She didn't know why, but I do in hindsight. I figured it all out, most of it. And it's been a huge path to healing for me. So I love that this person who wrote said that she is taking her time. She knows who she is, but she wants to make sure that all her ducks are in a row and that she figures herself out and becomes healthier so that when she gets into the relationship, it's from a place where she feels good in herself and she's bringing the best version of herself into that relationship. So good steps you're taking. I love it. She goes on, my only problem is coping with those bad nights and my anxiety with when my children are with my ex. I know they have a right to a relationship and he was only mean to me, not the kids. My ex is also in a relationship now, and I often wonder if he is controlling her. He is very good at disguising his issues and comes across as a good guy. I really do wish him all the happiness, but I just don't want to be near him. So, address a couple things here. You're coping with those bad nights and your anxiety when your children are with your ex. So you didn't tell me why. I mean, I can make assumptions here. You don't like him. You think he's not good for them. He might be a bad influence on them. I can understand that. But the why is important. If it's just because you don't like him, then definitely you need to work on that in yourself and the stuff we already talked about, trying to figure that out. But if it's because you think he's a bad influence, there's going to be a lot of bad influences in your children's lives. I know their father is, you'd want him to be the best influence possible, but I've said this before, children are brilliant. They really, really are. They are so smart and they will figure it out. And I had to tell this to a client before where her children would come back from her ex and the children would say things that daddy said about mommy. And they would say things like, well, daddy said that you took all his money when you got divorced. And he said that you are just really mean about it and you wouldn't let him have any money. You know, something like that. And now, what does mommy do? Mommy has to explain this to a child and explain that's not how it went and your daddy's a liar. I mean, how do you handle that? And this is my go-to every time. This is another communication tool with children or anyone that doesn't understand. Actually, you can use this with adults as well. When they come to you with some information and you feel like immediately explaining, no, that's not true at all, and this is really what happened, but you're up against somebody that says, no, this is true, and you need to believe it, how do you respond to that person when they tell you this? My go-to response is, do you think that's true? Do you think what daddy said is true? And then leave it at that. Because what's going to happen is you're going to show trust in the child or the other person, depending on who you do this with, in them enough to come up with their own answer. And when you show trust, instead of trying to convince them of anything, which in this case might be what daddy's doing, trying to convince the children how mean mommy is, mommy, instead of trying to defend herself or look crazy because she's like, what? Daddy said what? She's just going to say, well, do you think that's true? That shows immense trust in the children making their own decision. And then you'll realize just how smart they are. Now, they may get it wrong. They may say, well, daddy said this. And then you can follow up, well, do you think that's true? And the kid may say, well, I don't know. And what you want to happen is for that child or the other person to ask you questions. Do you think that's true? Well, I don't know. Did you take all daddy's money? And mommy might say, well, no, I didn't. We split it down the middle. And then leave it at that. Don't talk too much because you want the other person to ask questions. The person who asks questions is empowered. The person who asks questions is likely to feel more trusting. And the person who tries to convince that person, like daddy trying to convince children that mommy is a bad person, the children are going to figure out one of my parents is always feeding stories to us, and my other parent is trusting me to make up my own mind. Huh. That goes a long way. You may not get too far in the first conversation, but as this continues, the child smartens up. The child grows up, he or she smartens up, and suddenly they're realizing that maybe everything they hear from daddy or whoever's trying to convince them isn't necessarily true. Because they don't see mommy overreacting. They don't see her getting mad. Because guess what daddy did? Daddy probably said, mommy's going to get really angry when you bring it up. And that'll prove just how angry she got with me. You know, he's going to make stuff up. So we don't want to fulfill that prophecy. We want mommy, in this case, to just ask the question, well, do you think that's true? And again, that can work with anyone, not just children. If somebody comes to you with a story and you feel like defending yourself or explaining it the right way, you could ask that question and see what they say. This helps them access their inner wisdom because everyone has it. Everyone has that inner wisdom. Not everyone accesses it, but everyone has it. And hopefully when you ask that question, they'll access it. So I don't know your situation. I don't know why you deal with anxiety. If it's just because you don't like the guy or he was mean to you, that could be it. But children are really resilient. I lived with an abusive alcoholic for about 20 years of my life, and I had to get some therapy and I had to go through my own healing, but I made it and I'm fine, I think. I think for the most part, I'm fine. And there's so many people that have come from broken homes and one parent was narcissistic and one parent was emotionally abusive. There's so many people that had two bad parents and they get out of it. Most of them survive. Most of them get out of it. Most cases, children are resilient. And then when they leave the home, yeah, they might need help. They might need to talk to someone because they were brought up in a way that wasn't healthy. It was very toxic. And if their daddy has never been mean to them, maybe he's the greatest father on earth and the worst husband alive. That's just something that we have to look at and say, you know, he could have been the worst daddy on earth. And that, I can understand, would induce anxiety. You know, I look at my girlfriend and her ex and her shared custody of a child, and she really didn't like her child being with his dad, but she looked at all the benefits that that child had by being with his dad and all the luxuries that his dad was able to give her child, their child, that she would not have been able to give him. So she started seeing the positives of him having a father that provided in a lot of ways, even though he was not always the best person to be around. So she was able to start seeing the positive side of many of those things. And her kid smartened right up. He knew exactly what was going on. He knows his father inside and out now and can, you know, really see through some bad behavior, which is great because he figured it out. And his mom allowed him to figure it out. His mom didn't try to convince him the opposite way. And that's very important. She allowed him to feel empowered to figure it out himself. And he would ask questions. And those questions, my girlfriend would answer and give him the truth. And then he would have to assess all that data inside his head and figure out what really was true, because he would get different stories from his father. And then they grow up and they learn what's true because they figure it out. Your kids are going to be fine, it sounds like. Let me read the last paragraph and we'll end the show. She goes on to say, I guess the key to my rehabilitation is to listen to strategies, take what may work for me, and facilitate them into my daily life. I think we can sit in victim mode too long, dwelling on what has happened. Yes, that is true. I am pretty sure you have said similar in many of your podcasts. Keep up the fantastic work, and thank you for all your care. Thank you so much for sharing this. And yes, learning the strategies is very helpful. Learning all the tools that I talked about today, very helpful to communicating with certain people and facilitating those into your life, starting to practice those in different ways with less toxic people. You can practice this stuff with less toxic people. And you said something important. We can sit in victim mode too long. That means you're dwelling on the past. You're looking in the rearview mirror. You're wondering what you should have done differently, how you could have responded differently. That plagues us all. It really does. I mean, we all think about the past and what we could have done or should have done differently. Some of us are able to move beyond it. Some of us can't stop thinking about it. I tell you what, when you can't stop thinking about it, then listen to my episodes on obsession because those are obsessive thoughts we need to get rid of. Go to theoverwhelmedbrain.com, type in the word obsess, O-B-S-E-S-S. And you'll find episodes that I think will be very helpful to you, because we don't want to obsess about people or events and continually obsess about them. We want to heal from them and move on from them. If we're obsessing about them, then we don't have forward momentum. We may be moving forward, but is the happiness coming with us? Or is the happiness stuck behind those events that we still have in our mind? Did the happiness stop when those events happened and now all we feel is sadness or upset or anger? We need to get beyond that, and sometimes we have to look at that straight in the eye and make sure that we aren't stuck in that space that we feel like, because that happened, our life is terrible now and there's nothing we can do. Because as soon as you come to terms with what happened and realize, well, there's nothing I can do about what happened, I was a different person back then, otherwise I would have been able to handle it better. I mean, that involves self-forgiveness. If you think back and you go, I should have done this, I should have done that, then again, go to theoverwhelmedbrain.com and look up forgiveness, especially self-forgiveness. Because a lot of the times when we can't get past something, there's probably something inside ourselves that we need to forgive. And that usually involves behavior that we believe we should have done instead of what we did do. Even if it means forgiving ourselves for not having enough resources back then, or forgiving ourselves for allowing ourselves to get conned or hurt in some way when we should have been smarter. Because obviously we didn't have the tools or the resources back then, and now we do, and now we have an opportunity to use them. We just have to forgive ourselves and move on, and that is a process as well, and that can be very helpful. And I hope that you don't stay in victim mode, no matter who you are, no matter what you went through, even though you may have been a victim If you were a victim, you were a victim. Absolutely. I'm not invalidating that. I'm saying what she's saying is that, yeah, we can spend a long time looking in the rearview mirror, telling ourselves, if that didn't happen, my life would be different today. But how much time do you want to spend doing that? It would be great to move on. And sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes we have to heal from this stuff. Sometimes we are carrying around PTSD, and that might need to be addressed as well. But once you address it, then you can start moving forward and you can start feeling good again, feeling good inside yourself. Might take some work, but I know you can do this. You're listening to this show. That's a step. It's a step in the right direction, I think. And you might have a long way to go, or maybe you have just a few more steps. So keep walking in that direction and you'll gain forward momentum and you'll continue, because the snowball will get bigger and bigger as it rolls downhill, and pretty soon you'll be unstoppable. That's what I want for you. Thank you so much to this person who wrote, and thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I appreciate you. We'll be right back with my thank yous and my goodbyes and my final words right after this. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want to thank the following patrons of the week. These are the financial backers of the show: James and Amy and Kay and Angela and Kate. Wow, generous contributors. Thank you, Crystal, Nikki, Kathleen. Kathleen, you're a new member. So glad to have you on board. Thank you so much for your support. Lisa, you're a longtime member. A bunch of you are, actually. Victoria, Tracy, I am so grateful for all of you. Like I said, these are the people that choose to give financially to the show, from a few bucks to more. And it's helpful. Every single person that contributes is how we keep going, is how we keep the show on the air. And we're going on 7 years now, November, 7 years. Thank you so much to the contributors. And of course, I can't forget the donation from Carl. Carl, thank you so much for your donation. I read your words. You said, thank you so much for the supportive, thoughtful work and podcast, for your honesty and for sharing. They have made a tremendous difference. Thank you. Oh, wow, Carl. My heart is warm. Thank you so much. It made my day. And everyone that donates to the show, everyone that's a contributing patron, I am grateful for you. If you are getting value from the show and you would like to give back, head over to moretob.com and you'll see the options there. And feel free to take any one of those options if you'd like. And of course, when you're in the patron program, I also give back. There's a bunch of private episodes and workbooks and worksheets and discounts on my products and things like that over at the patron site. So not only are you contributing, but you're also getting back. I like to give back when I can. So head over to moretob.com if you're interested in that. I'd also like to remind you of the Love and Abuse podcast over at loveandabuse.com. You know, if you find yourself not able to identify what's happening in your relationship and you feel like you're being blamed for everything wrong with it, maybe you're in an emotionally abusive situation. Visit loveandabuse.com, get the workbook or listen to the podcast, and you'll learn a lot. There's a lot of stuff I talk about over there that I don't get into over here, and I get into detail over there. So any type of difficult relationship you have, that show can be helpful. loveandabuse.com. And finally, I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for some of the music transitions in The Overwhelmed Brain. So what's interesting about today's episode is that it kind of got into some of the stuff, or at least a couple of the things I talked about in an older episode I did, and also an ebook I wrote called How to Deal with Irrational People. And the techniques in that can be very helpful to accompany everything I talked about today. You can actually find that at Amazon, or I believe I still have the episode on the air. I'm not sure. You go to theoverwhelmedbrain.com and you can find that episode. Just look up the word irrational. Actually, I think it's a popular search in Google. If you look up how to deal with irrational people in Google, it's probably like one of the first. But you can find it on my website. My point is that dealing with irrational people is a lot of tools that you can use, because people who are irrational sometimes in the same boat as people who aren't irrational and calculated. And it's an interesting combination of different tools and stuff that I include in this episode and that episode that can really help fill your emotional tool belt. And when you start to realize there are ways to communicate with people that don't lead to heated conversations or out and out arguments, your life starts to improve. You start realizing that you don't have to have the same interactions with the same people all the time. You know, I find that people often need tools when they're dealing with toxic family. Yes, we need them for toxic partners and stuff, but toxic family, it's hard to get away from them. I mean, a toxic partner, you would eventually maybe leave or work things out or whatever, but toxic family, how do you get away from them? Sometimes you have to move away, but if you have toxic family, what do you do when your dad or your mom or your sister or your brother always bring up the same things? Like, oh, you don't have a job yet. Oh, you're voting for that particular person. Oh, they give you a hard time about something. Tools like this can be very helpful because it squashes the conversation so it doesn't go anywhere. Just saying, yeah, you're probably right. You know, I am voting for that person. I might be wrong. Well, damn right you're wrong. They're going to say something like that, maybe. And then they'll go off and they'll say, well, this is why and this is why. And you'll think, yeah, okay. And then you can say, or, yeah, you are probably right. You know what? I'm gonna consider those words. There's another mini tool I like to use. You know what? I'm going to consider what you just said. Thank you so much. That's a great one when somebody is convincing you of something. It's sort of like my mom a long time ago when I was in my first relationship, my first long-term relationship. My mom says, aren't you going to have kids? And I thought, mom, I don't know. I'm in my 20s. I'm not really thinking about kids right now. And maybe I should. I don't know. And she asked my girlfriend and I, and my girlfriend definitely didn't want kids at the time. Or ever. She said, no, we're not going to have kids. And I thought, yeah, I don't really want kids either. And she's like, what? She says, you're not going to have kids? Why are you so selfish? You're not going to have kids. Why are you being so selfish? And I asked her, what do you mean selfish? How is that selfish? And I forget what she said, but I thought, that's what a strange response. Why am I being so selfish? And, you know, some people have thoughts on that, and that's fine. But I was pretty sure I didn't want to have kids, and my girlfriend at the time definitely didn't want to have kids. So we made a decision not to, and my mom couldn't understand it. And so a response like, mom, you know, you bring up some good points. I'll think about that, would probably have been better instead of the conversation that we had, which was filled with me being highly resistant, and my girlfriend, too. We were both highly resistant. I mean, we were very uncomfortable, too. Like, well, you know, we don't want kids. Well, why don't you want kids? You're being so selfish. You don't want to bring kids into the world. I mean, what else is there to do? You know, I forget what she said, but, you know, she had quite a few kids. I'm one of them. I'm sure her perspective is a lot different than mine and my girlfriend's. And I realized years later that it would have been more productive to say, you know what? That's a good point. I will think about that. Thank you so much. I would try to sound more convincing because that sounded sort of condescending, but I would have said something like that. All right, well, that's a great point, Mom. You've given me a lot to think about. Thank you so much. And then we wouldn't have to have that conversation anymore because I've created a delay where we don't have to discuss it. I'll think about it. Now, if the next day she said, well, have you thought about it? I would say, I need more time. You know, this is a big decision. Then we wouldn't have to talk about it anymore. So there was a point in time where my mom said that. Later on in life, when my siblings started having kids and she became a little bit overwhelmed with all the grandkids, she came to me and said, you know what? I'm so glad you didn't have kids. You know, not that I didn't want you to have kids and I would have loved them, but we have so many kids in our family now. She goes, everything I said, I'm just so glad you didn't have kids, and I definitely will not give you a hard time about that anymore. I was like, well, thank you, Mom. Thank you so much. You know, she goes, no, I'm serious. I'm really glad you didn't have kids. And I thought, wow, what a change. This is amazing. She has changed a lot over the years, and she has gotten through so much, you know, being in that abusive relationship with my stepfather and having gotten past her own personal growth stuff. She's just gone through a lot. So her attitude has changed. Her personality has not improved, but it shifted into something happier and something brighter. And I see it, I feel it every time I'm with her. And it's just interesting that you could have a conversation that starts off, well, I can't believe you're being so selfish not having kids. and then have it later turn into, I'm so glad you didn't have any kids, and it's meaningful. It meant something. And even now, when I go see her again, every now and then I'll bring it up. Aren't you glad that I didn't have kids too, Mom? You should see the relief on her face. Oh my God, yes. So it can happen. Family can turn around. They can become different people. They can improve. Doesn't happen often enough, but it does happen. And it is helpful when you are not showing all this resistance, and when you can make them feel like you are listening, you do understand what they're saying, and that you will give it thought. That can be a great way to placate them for now. You may never come to a place where you appease them, but if they're family, then maybe they should love you no matter what you do, within reason. Maybe they should just support you no matter what, within reason, because people who love and support you care about you even if they disagree with you. That's, I believe, how it should go. And when it doesn't go that way, then we have challenges. We should be able to vote for different people and still love and support each other because we're that kind of person. But if they're voting for someone we don't like and we think that's a hit against us, then we're going to feel slighted. We're going to feel like they don't care about us, because obviously if they did, they would vote for the person that we like. You know, I know I'm talking about voting because voting is like right around the corner. At least as I'm recording this, we're just about into the 2020 elections. Not going to talk about it. But that's on my mind, and it's probably on the minds of many families. And imagine if we didn't have all this conflict in our families right now because of all these politics. How can we get through a family dinner without it coming up? I like some of the processes I talked about today, some of the little tools that you can have available to you, and remembering Tai Chi conversations. You allow the energy to pass right by you, let it go by you, and let them continue to look for that resistance that they can't find, because you don't want to lose your power. I hope today has helped in some way, shape, or form. And if it hasn't, always keep an open mind. That helps you step into your power and be firm in your decisions and actions. That's how you create the life you want. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You are powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing.